This week I'm joined by George Pendle to discuss his book Strange Angel, The Otherworldly Life of Rocket Scientist John Whiteside Parsons, alongside discussions on Thelema, Aleister Crowley, rocket science and occultism. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my patrons and subscribers for making all this work possible, and if you'd like to support Emetics or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. So, George Pendle, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be discussing the sort of the work and the life of Jack Parsons. You wrote the book Strange Angel, The Otherworldly Life of Rocket Scientist John Whiteside Parsons. You know, I think I agree with the title, but I think, like, and you would agree that rocket scientist just doesn't cover it, really. And this, many people will now know, is sort of the basis, I'm sure we'll get into this, but the basis for the series Strange Angel, which now is in like two series. So George, sort of tell us a little bit about yourself, and also, you know, how this book came about. How did it happen?
I'm a journalist by trade. I started, this is like 20 years ago. I started out of university and I went straight into working for the Times of London. And while I was there, I was, you know, doing all the usual kind of cub journalist stuff. But I was, you know, desperately looking for a bigger project. And while I was working there, I was also freelancing for an art magazine called Freeze, which you may be familiar with. And they had asked me to do a piece on Kenneth Anger. Kenneth Anger, for those listeners who don't know, is a kind of experimental avant-garde filmmaker. I think he's still alive, remarkably. But he made a lot of films in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, which had a kind of occult tinge to them. And while I was writing this piece on Kenneth Anger, I noticed that one of his actresses was this woman called Marjorie Cameron. And looking up some details in an avant-garde kind of film studies book, there was a footnote. And in that footnote was the fact that Marjorie Cameron, it said, was married to the rocket scientist occultist Jack Parsons. And that was pretty much it. And I just thought, okay, I turned over the page, tried to find some more about it. And there was nothing there. And, you know, at the time, this is probably like 2001, 2002, maybe, you know, there was nothing online about Parsons. There was literally maybe a page, maybe two pages. It seems ridiculous now, but there was really nothing on him. And so I thought I had to look into the story, and that's how it all came about. And then the more I started digging, the more I found that was kind of absurd and ridiculous and you know, needed more digging. And it just kind of, you know, I just dug this giant hole that, you know, eventually saw me leaving the Times and kind of concentrating on writing this book.
That's interesting. I mean, the sort of the pre-internet era when something suddenly, you know, even thinking of that pre-internet era now is sort of strange, or like that early internet era, whereas like nowadays, if you can't find something on someone or even like a note, that, you know, that's hidden. That is rare.
Right.
So,
it's very interesting how that's kind of flipped. I mean, you know, at the time, it kind of all, the fact there wasn't much on Parsons didn't really seem to give it, you know, it gave it a bit of an occult air, but I think now not being found on the internet, it gives it a really big occult air. You know, you're just like, well, you know, who can hide themselves from the all-seeing eye of Google, you know?
Definitely. I mean, I know a few publishers who sort of managed to do that by, like, explicitly making it clear that you're not allowed to, like, upload or scan in any of their work, which is pretty cool. But other than that, I mean, other than really setting that line early on and making it clear, there's no way you can escape it. So this was 2005, you say this was published?
Well, it was published in, yes, I guess early 2005. So I spent about 2 years writing it, kind of 2002 to 2004.
Mm-hmm. So considering, like, as you say, you know, there was nothing online about him, how was it received?
When it finally came out?
Yeah, yeah.
It was received pretty well. It got some nice reviews. I think it would have been received better now than it probably was back then. I think, and whether, you know, I think the whole growth of interest in kind of the occult has definitely come about. There's definitely been a big upswing in the last 15, 20 years, and also in just maverick characters like Parsons. I mean, it got some good reviews. A certain group of people really liked it, and I'm glad to say it's still kind of, you know, finding its way into the corners of the world. But, you know, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which Jack Parsons founded, didn't want anything to do with it. And
are they still,
you know,
they're still around.
Oh yeah, they're still around. They're a giant kind of space organization, funded by the government, that really deals in all unmanned spaceflight out of, you know, America. So it's a giant national organization. But when I sent it to them and said, "Hey, would you like me to come in and give a talk or anything?" They didn't want anything to do with this rather disreputable person. And I think now people are more, you know, they're easy about that. They want scientists to have character, and they want scientists to be humans rather than, you know, white coated kind of, you know, kind of figures with no humanity. But I think that's loosened up. So I think it would have been a bit more successful now, or at least had a larger audience quicker. But, you know, I was glad to have done it, and it opened up a lot of doors. I think quite a few people who, you know, came upon the book and were surprised by it and got in touch with me. So I'm happy with it.
That's good. So before we sort of move into the content of the book, I mean, I'm sure we'll come back to that idea of Parsons not really the in, you know, scare marks, the professionals, so to speak, not wanting to have anything to do with him, which is a recurrent theme all the way through to 2005, it seems. I have to ask you the hermetics question, which is, you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on a conversation. Who do you pick? And of course, we're talking about a specific person, Parsons. So he's already in the room, and you get to invite three more in.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I'm always a little nervous about this question, because I have met one of my heroes, and it wasn't a great meeting, and unfortunately, it's kind of ruined everything ever since with that writer, a writer who I greatly respect. So I'd really have to be listening through the keyhole. But when I was thinking about Parsons, I was thinking about the people who were really affecting me at the time I wrote it, and one of them is Eric Davis. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're familiar with him,
he was on one of the earliest guests on the show when he released like his latest book on McKenna and Philip K. Dick.
That's right. I mean, basically, when I was starting Parsons, writing about Parsons, I'd already been introduced to his book Technosis, which is, as you know, a kind of this masterful study of kind of techno mysticism. And, you know, drawing this kind of through line from ancient pagan religion to, you know, the internet and current high tech, current high tech world. And, you know, it just seemed to chime so beautifully with Parsons, who was this man, you know, at the cutting edge of science. And yet he traced his way back, all the way back to, Newton or even further back to magicians and shamans. It was just a perfect kind of book to have as my guide in writing it. And I think, you know, Eric Davis, he's had a podcast for a while called Expanding Mind, which might be on hiatus at the moment, but it's just been a wonderful thing to listen to. He's so lucid and in depth, and yet never kind of his conversations on the weirdest stuff, and that is his, you know, area of study, weird studies. Never kind of feels as though it's going, you know, getting flabby or going off on tangents. He's always like very precise about the obscure, if you can say that. And so I would, you know, love to have him in a room. And, you know, other than him, you know, they would all be writers, basically, the thinkers that you asked for. They're all writers. The other one would be Jorge Luis Borges, who has been my favorite writer for a very long time. And similarly, you know, in his metaphysical detective stories, I'd just love to, you know, listen to him and his kind of mixture of mysticism and mathematical precision. I mean, in a similar way to Eric Davis, or Eric Davis is similar to Borges in this kind of mixture of science and mysticism. And that idea of, you know, it kind of, a feedback loop, the kind of meditative trance of his writing that you get. So that'd be the first two. Would you like me to go into any more depth as to why I'd have Borges?
I'm trying to think. I mean, I hope I'm right in thinking. I mean, I think I've just realized I've pronounced his name wrong my whole life. Do you mean, you talking about Jean-Louis Borges?
No.
Okay.
Jorge-Louis Borges. The
I was like,
writer. Do you know?
Hang on, I'm going to have to make... How do you spell his surname?
B-O-R-G-E-S.
Yeah. I've pronounced... Wow, pronounced his name so badly my whole life. Yeah, I know who you mean, yeah. I've only read... I've probably pronounced this wrong as well, but Fiction, is it Fiction?
Yeah.
It's the only one I've read. Wow. What an embarrassment.
No, I often find I have a relationship in print with somebody, and I have their name in my head, and then I come to actually discuss it with somebody, and I realize it's completely different to how I thought it was pronounced. It's funny you mention that. But yeah, so I mean, you know, Borges and Davis and you know, provide these kind of labyrinthine kind of studies that you can kind of go down and get lost in. And you know, and they have it, both of them kind of discuss the edges of reality, and I've always loved that. You know, in my journalism, in my writing, what I try and do is pick at the edges of reality, but I feel those guys have like a real firm concept of what's beyond it. And then, you know, the third person, I was thinking, how do you kind of weigh those other two? And I wanted somebody, you know, totally without subtext, totally plain and simple, and almost zen-like in their basic means of thought, you know, in their simplicity. And it was P.G. Woodhouse. There's something about him which is this kind of empty frivolity, which I find always kind of beautiful and enervating, and energy giving, and anti-serious, and I thought that would be a good balance to the other two. So I'd have Eric Davis and Borges and P.G. Woodhouse.
I mean, I never thought Woodhouse would be in Hermetics at all, but I love the fact that I like Woodhouse. I've read a couple, but I love the fact that Woodhouse and Parsons are basically the most quintessential, you know, English and American, like, in terms of character, they are as quintessential as you could get for sort of the 1930s and 40s. So, that's an interesting run, but I'm not sure. I feel like Woodhouse, by the end of it, would probably feel a bit alone, or do you think he'd sort of laugh it off?
I think you're absolutely right. I think he'd probably, raise an eyebrow, right, and make some sides.
Why have you invited me in?
Yeah, and then probably light his pipe and kind of, drift off into dreams. But there's something about, with the other three, I think there's so much mystery, and the lack of mystery in Woodhouse is kind of what I just have there, just in case I myself got a little too, overwrought listening to them.
Yeah. See, now I was hoping you were going to say Crowley, because Parsons didn't, I mean, obviously for those who don't know, we'll get into this, Parsons has an interest in rocketry and thelema, the mystical or religious tradition of Crowley, but he doesn't meet Crowley, does he?
No, he doesn't. I mean, I was kind of with Parsons. I was, you know, doing the two birds with one stone. I figured, you know, if we just had those two together, it would be, well, maybe it would. It would be an interesting moment. They never actually met in person, although they corresponded frequently by letter.
Yeah.
And they were at one point very close to meeting, but never actually did. I mean, Parsons lived his whole life in California, pretty much, with a few jaunts around the United States, and one to Europe when he was a child, but he never crossed paths with Crowley. And so what we have is a kind of just a correspondence that charts both their joy at meeting each other and then their slow and kind of rather vicious falling out.
That's strange. I mean, that's an odd one. I mean, obviously at the time when Parsons is sort of, you know, coming into his own with respect to the lemur and doing the bigger rituals, this is when Crowley would have probably been on, you know, 7 grams of heroin a day or whatever it was.
That's exactly right. No, I went to the Warburg Institute and looked at his diaries for the time that he was corresponding to Parsons, and yeah, his diaries, which are wonderful, they have a little code which is a little dot on each page, and each dot refers to how many it's not grams, but how many, he has a certain term for it, it's like a speck of heroin or something like that. Yeah. And so you see just the dots like getting bigger and bigger and like more of them and more of them, all during like the late 1930s and 40s, which was the time of their correspondence, also the time of, you know, the Second World War. So so he was really, his health was failing. He was definitely firmly addicted to heroin at the time. And he was just, you know, incredibly poor. He had very little money and was kind of scrounging around for whatever he could just to keep going.
Yeah, so I mean, before we jump into the mystical stuff, because that sort of does come later, you know, I think one thing to point out, because, you know, the I guess the two really important factors for Parsons' life is that he was a rocket scientist, he was into rocketry, and he was into Thelema. Now, Thelema is almost in a certain sense actually the least strange one here, because people nowadays would think, oh, rocketry, that's a cool career, like SpaceX, you know, that's a, if you wanted to go into that career, you could probably find a way. Not so, right? Not so in Parsons' day. This is basically seen as, you know, people now who would be like, I'm inventing perpetual motion in my garage.
Exactly. I mean, at least Thelema had like, you know, a textbook you could go back to study it. Rocketry had nothing. I mean, really, it had, at the time Parsons was, you know, getting interested in it, which was the kind of late 1920s, early 1930s, Thelema was on much firmer standing than rocketry. You know, the rockets had been built, it's true, for centuries, but they'd never been studied. They'd been, you know, invented probably 1000 AD, you know, somewhere in China, and used as kind of fireworks and kind of very basic kind of scare weapons. I mean, there'd been rockets used in the War of Independence in America. The British had rockets, you know, the rocket's red glare. That's actually, you know, a weapon that the British used at the time. But nobody had studied it. And by the early 20th century, they were just seen as really pretty much, you know, gimmicks. And anybody who was studying it was seen as, you know, seen as a lunatic. And you know, lunatic, the very word, traveling to the moon, kind of sums up what rockets, you know, rockets were seen as just being a story device that, that people used in science fiction stories, you know, to get people to the moon. Anybody who actually thought they could be real were, you know, were lambasted. There were a couple of people, you know, Robert Goddard, who was an American scientist, who had tried to get the American scientific establishment interested in like 1910 or so. But when one of his experiments had gone wrong and had, you know, a rocket had crashed into the roof of somebody in Massachusetts, he had just been absolutely kind of chased away. And he ended up living pretty much a hermetic existence down in the desert in New Mexico, I think it was, where he practiced by himself but wouldn't allow anybody to see what he was doing. He had been completely kind of ruined by the publicity, the bad publicity that had surrounded him. And so rockets, as with many things, you know, in many new technologies, rockets were left in the hands of kids. The only kind of real, well, real program that was going on were these little rocket societies that were spread around the world. There was one in England, there was one in Russia, one in Germany, and one in America, which were basically like teenage kids who were like sending letters to each other saying, oh, I'm trying to build a rocket. You know, I'm trying to get to the moon with this rocket, and I've got a coffee maker here, and I'm going to, you know, fill it full of gunpowder I scraped out of my grandfather's shotgun shells, and, you know, do all this kind of stuff. And that was really the only kind of rocket work that was going on. No universities taught it. Nobody was interested in it. Everybody was interested in airplanes, but rockets were going nowhere. And so for Parsons to kind of enter this world of rocketry, you've got to understand, you know, and to do it seriously and to really want to, you know, to move it forward. I mean, you have to understand he was a kid. He was, you know, in his late teens when he started working on it, kind of building rockets in his backyard. But you also have to understand he didn't care. he was purely, I mean, he had nobody to back him. He was purely driven by his dreams. And that's how he entered rocketry. It was really a kind of dream-based science at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Parsons' attitude towards rocketry reminds me of that famous Magnus Carlsen quote where they, you know, the chess player, where there's been like a really bad earthquake where they're playing the night before, and a couple of the other professional players are talking about it, and they ask him about it, so what do you think about this earthquake? And he says, what the hell's that got to do with chess, right? Parsons seems just so absolutely, like everything in his life was secondary to rocketry.
Yeah. And that was, you know, it's hard to work out exactly why he was so driven in that respect. I mean, there's very few, as I was, even now, 20 years on after I've written the book, pretty much, or, you know, 15 years on, very little has come out on his early life. All we do know, and I think, the thing that really drove him on was science fiction stories and these kind of new magazines, the pulp magazines that were available in the United States at the time, called like Weird Tales or Amazing Stories or Astounding Stories of Science Fiction. And they had all come out just as he was kind of becoming a teenager. And I just think he was, you know, rather like, I'm trying to think of a similar, it's a bit like the computer guys in the 70s, you know, these guys who were just like why did they think computers were going to go so far? You know, nobody knows, but it seemed to them obvious. And for some reason, it seemed to Parsons obvious that, and to quite a few science fiction readers, that one day man would walk on the moon and that the only way he could get there was via rockets.
Yeah, I mean, so what are you, you know, trying to draw the two together? I mean, you say about Parsons' early life. I mean, I think the only thing we could bring in there which seems to be of importance was his relationship with his father, Marvel, who, by all accounts, was a really strange person too.
Yeah, Marvel, which is, you know, why Jack Parsons, what Jack Parsons was originally called. He was originally called Marvel Parsons after his father, but perhaps fortunately for him, it was changed. Marvel Parsons was, you know, a kind of distant figure. He had cheated on his wife and eventually, you know, left the household when Jack Parsons was a young boy. And so Parsons was raised by his mother and by his grandparents and really never saw his father again, you know, until very late on in his life in the 1940s when he found out his father was in St. Elizabeth, which is at the time was called a lunatic asylum, just outside Washington, D.C. But for a large swathe of Parsons' life, Marvel Parsons wasn't around. He was this kind of shadow figure who only appears later in Parsons' life to kind of hold this rather terrifying, you know, specter of mental illness over Parsons' own head. So, you know, really Parsons, you know, he was helped by his grandfather to build rockets a little bit, I think. But he didn't really have a father figure to guide him. And that's why, you know, that's where Crowley comes in. And that's where a lot of the people he got involved with kind of, they took the place of a father for him in a lot of ways. And I think Parsons was always looking for a kind of father figure.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, people were probably thinking, well, how does this all fit together with Lima and rocketry? You know, where does this first, should we say, initiation or investigation into Thelema come about? Why do you think that mystical element, that idea that he could, you know, perhaps become a god or go beyond god or have superhuman powers, why do you think that was so important to him as well?
Well, I, you know, although they seem absolutely opposite, the, you know, the disciplines of rocketry and the occult actually kind of, you know, fit together pretty well when you look at them. You know, they're all about, you know, exploring new worlds. They're all about getting off the planet Earth. They're all about changing reality to a certain extent. And, you know, Parsons, I think, was originally interested in rocketry, but the occult to him would have seemed not such a huge, you know, leap, I think. I mean, everybody had always told him that rocketry wouldn't work and everybody said that magic wouldn't work. So to him, it was just like, well, you know, I'm doing pretty well with the rocketry. Why can't I make the magic work? And so to him, I mean, his success at rocketry, I think, you know, enabled him to seize on, you know, on Crowley's work and the occult, in a kind of really open and positive and, you know, kind of optimistic way. He really thought, you know, he was standing on the cusp of being great in two fields, both as a scientist and a magician. Okay. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that does answer the question. So where, how old was he when he first started taking it seriously?
Well, you know, throughout his early years, we get a few little snippets of how he's interested in, you know, weird stuff. At the age of 12, he said he summoned the devil, you know, into his room. I mean, I think a lot of people put a lot of weight onto that. But I think, you know, messing around with a Ouija board when you're 12, 13, you know, I think we can see something like that. He always had an interest in that kind of dark side of reality. But he didn't actually get interested in the OTO until he was in his early 20s, maybe 23, I think. And he was invited to the Los Angeles Lodge of the Ordo Templi Orientis, which was Crowley's kind of society. And he was invited there by some friends. We're not exactly sure who, but he was invited to go and visit the Gnostic Mass. And that's the kind of celebration based on Crowley's writing. I mean, Parsons describes, you know, going up the stairs and entering this kind of vaulted loft in this large LA kind of house. And there was the kind of black and white checkerboard floor, you know, very similar to a kind of Masonic kind of lodge, I think, in a way. And there was an altar, and there was a coffin, and, you know, there was somebody there with a spear, and there was, you know, a lady in diaphanous robes. And this was the Gnostic Mass of Crowley. And I think Parsons was so amazed that this was going on, you know, underneath his nose, almost in the same city as he lived, that he just fell, you know, he fell for it deep, and he realized that there were people who were also striving to kind of, you know, get mankind to a different state, but in a different way. And so so around about 1937, I think, was the first time he was introduced to it. And I think one of his friends said, you know, it was like water to a thirsty man. His first appearance there. And from there, you know, he started. The lodge was run by a chap called Wilfred Smith, who had been one of Crowley's disciples. And Smith kind of saw Parsons and learnt that he was working in rocketry, and, you know, probably had a bit of money behind him, and thought, you know, let's get him involved. And you know, he didn't need to encourage. He didn't need to, you know, trick Parsons into joining. He just gave him books, and Parsons lapped them up. And I think Parsons saw, you know, the idea that he could really take on Crowley's teachings and spread them further in America.
I mean, just out of interest, I don't want to get you into any trouble here, but what do you make of Thelema?
Well, I am not a believer in Thelema, but I'm a believer in other people's belief in it. This is something which I've tried to, you know, in writing the book on Parsons, the one thing I didn't want to do was in any way try and, you know, say how, you know, it's ridiculous, you know, people dressed up in these costumes spouting this poetry, because it's just the knee-jerk reaction to a lot of occult stuff. And, you know, Parsons was a clever guy, a very clever guy, and he was interested in it. And I think we owe it and him the, you know, the benefit of the doubt that he obviously saw something in it that I don't personally see, but which I'm interested in what he saw in it. So that's kind of where I stand in Thelema. I'm, you know, the OTO, which still exists, helped me out enormously in writing the book, and I have the utmost respect for it, you know, and the people who believe in it. And as a way of thinking, I think it's fascinating, you know, this kind of transcendental kind of religion, amongst many others at the time that were going on. I mean, that's the interesting thing. There were many other types of transcendence going on, but, you know, Crowley's always had like a certain something to them that, that's hard to quantify. I mean, why do you think Thelema has this? Why do you think Crowley's, you know, has this pull that other people perhaps don't?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. A lot of other groups, I mean, arguably one of the biggest groups ever, which is what Thelema sort of evolved from, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, even though they're so big, they're not as well sort of popularly known. And I think obviously the pull for Thelema is, I mean, how can you not be interested in something that was created by a man called the Great Beast, you know, who sharpens his own teeth and, you know, all these absolutely insane myths, you know, scales mountains back when there was no mountain equipment and does all these crazy rituals and, you know, summoned, is it Charonzon in the desert and things along these lines. How can you not be sort of interested into, you know, what's going on there? So I think, but I also think that they play on the, even though Crowley states quite a few times actually that the Thelema isn't in any sense evil or left-hand path, they play on the aesthetic of that a lot. And I think people are always going to be intrigued in that, by that dark side of, you know, human potential.
Yeah, no, I think that's really well put. And I think Parsons definitely was attracted to that side, not just in the beginning, but all the way through. I think when he eventually kind of, I do think that Thelema, to a certain extent at this point, was a kind of personality cult, like you say. I think Crowley had, you know, being in touch with Crowley was, you know, a really almost quasi-religious, you know, fact for many of the members. But I do think that, you know, Parsons in some way kind of saw through that to a certain extent and kind of wanted, you know, ultimately wanted to form his own religion that rode on the back of Crowley's writings. And, you know, I think he eventually kind of, you know, pulled the curtain away from Crowley and kind of realized maybe he's not, you know, he might be called the wickedest man in the world, but maybe he's not, you know, the great leader that I thought he was. Maybe he needs help. I think that's what Parsons thought, you know.
Well, at that point, he most definitely did. I think by, you know, at that point, Crowley was probably close to handing it over to Grady Murtry near the end anyway. But so what do you think, you know, Parsons' attitude towards Crowley himself was? I mean, obviously this changes drastically. But initially, do you think it is this simple father figure thing, or do you think he sees something more there?
Well, I think, you know, cod psychology would say the father figure is definitely, you know, it's definitely one part of it. I mean, you have this, you know, a distant father who's not seen, but who corresponds with you, unlike Marvel. You know, it's you can paint all sorts of visions and fill in the gaps, and, you know, also, you know, he's achieved a great lot, which you don't know anything about your own father, and you can slot in, you know, like you say, Crowley, he's a chess master, he's a mountaineer, he's a impresario, he's a, you know, he's all sorts of things that your father isn't. So I do think there is a bit of that. I mean, I also think there's just something about Crowley's writings which just spoke to him. And I mean, specifically, I'm not entirely sure what it is, except that I think, you know, Parsons had one foot in the Victorian era and one foot in the modern era. And I think Crowley provided for him, like you say, the Order of the Golden Dawn, this kind of access to the Victorian era. I mean, I find, you know, a lot of Crowley's writings are the work of a Victorian person. You know, they have this real kind of, I don't know, kind of funk of Victoria to them. And I think Parsons saw in that, you know, something which he himself, you know, really clung to. I mean, one of Parsons' favorite books at the time was The Golden Bough. And, you know, this kind of, this study of kind of magic through history, and how it became religion and how it became, you know, eventually science. And I think, you know, Parsons saw in Crowley a kind of, you know, a figure who fit into the Golden Bough perfectly, who was this kind of magus who had, you know, who was both magic and science together. That may be a bit vague. I don't know if I have any really, you know, absolute reasons why Parsons fell for Crowley so strongly. But there was something about his authority as a kind of Victorian figure, you know, and as a father figure that I think he really, you know, was enamored of.
So why was it that they eventually sort of fell out?
Well, eventually Parsons, you know, went off piste, so to speak. He, you know, ultimately he always wanted to have some kind of reaction from his magical rituals, and I don't think he was getting those through Crowley's rituals. I mean, he would you know, practice the sex magic rituals, which Crowley is famous for, but he wouldn't get enough action from them. You know, even though I think Thelema, you know, is very much an internal religion, it's very much about the will and one's own will. You know, Parsons became increasingly obsessed with the causing change, you know, visible change that more than one person can see. And I think he just kind of, you know, was looking for more. He was looking, as in his rockets, he was looking for bigger and bigger explosions. So in his magic, he was looking for more phenomena. And so he started kind of adding bits of, you know, changing the rituals, adding new bits, stealing stuff from voodoo, maybe, you know, writing his own kind of magical rituals. And when Crowley found out about this, he was, you know, very angry. You know, Crowley's not a guy that you mess with his texts. And yet it seemed like Parsons slowly but surely was not only kind of making these new rituals and kind of really pushing Crowley's teachings to the very, you know, to the very edge of what Crowley meant, but he was taking a lot of people with him. And I think, you know, Crowley found out about this through his various correspondences with other people in the lodge, and was furious, you know, and, you know, ultimately it all kind of crumbled when, with the arrival of L. Ron Hubbard in Parsons' life. And that's when Parsons really started doing, you know, magic that I think Crowley was appalled by. Now, it's always odd to read Crowley and read him being appalled by anybody, because you kind of feel like, surely this man shouldn't be so angry, considering what he's done in his time. But when it came to the OTO, he was, you know, he seemed to be very, you know, dictatorial, certainly, in what people were allowed to do. And Parsons seems to just want to go on to keep, you know, trying new things. And that wasn't really, you know, what the OTO was about, or at least what Crowley didn't think it was about.
Yeah, I mean, you talk there about L. Ron Hubbard, obviously the originally the founder of Dianetics, which is now more commonly known as Scientology, coming onto the scene and sort of changing Parsons' direction. And it was always a shame to me with the series that came out, and I did watch both seasons. It sort of it ends just before this era in Parsons' life, but I do remember thinking, I wonder if they've like they I don't know what the truth is, but I remember thinking, I wonder if they just didn't get another season, or they thought there's no way we're going to be able to get past the Church of Scientology in terms of, you know, putting L. Ron Hubbard on screen, right?
Yeah, well, interestingly, you know, when I was writing the book, I got a bit of blowback from Scientology, but not a lot. And I think they themselves are trying to move away from the cult of personality of Hubbard. So I think, you know, the TV series, unfortunately, I think is over, but I don't think it's, well, I mean, it's interesting that it should have been cancelled with L. Ron Hubbard arriving on the screen in front of you. But I'm not sure if there is, I don't know. It's hard to tell. I don't know if there's a conspiracy behind it. it might just be that they didn't know where to go, or it wasn't getting enough viewers, you know, quite frankly.
Okay. So did Parsons, like, and how developed was Dianetics at the time? Did Parsons really, you know, read anything of it, or was that not something?
No. When L. Ron Hubbard met him, he was just a science fiction writer. I don't know. A lot of people don't know, but he was a very popular science fiction writer for the pulps that Parsons read in the late 30s, 40s. And this was before he wrote Dianetics or had codified that into the Church of Scientology. And so what you have in Hubbard at this time is a guy who's searching around for ideas, you know, and you can see him kind of, I mean, ultimately you can see quite a bit of Crowley in Dianetics and in Scientology. But at the time, this is pre that. And I think he got a lot of the influence for Dianetics from his friendship with Parsons. So Parsons and Hubbard are both in their early 30s. And, you know, Hubbard is a successful science fiction writer, which Parsons holds almost as important as a, you know, successful science writer, as a great science brain. And he kind of takes him along for the ride. He says, you know, Hubbard, I want to do new magical works. And Hubbard encourages him and becomes his kind of, you know, his scribe, his assistant in all these workings that infuriated Crowley.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah.
So one more thing there's a couple more things on magic that I think we should add in, because once from my understanding is actually like has become a bit more popular because I think it wasn't too well known, which is the what's known as the Babylon working, which seems to be sort of Parsons' most original, or you know, the his big thing in magic that he wanted to do, which I believe, you know, was like a mixture, basically a key mixture between rocketry and magic.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting moment in Parsons' life. I mean, I'm just trying to see it as a, you know, it's an extension of his personality. And he had at this time recently lost his girlfriend to L. Ron Hubbard. So he and Thelema had said that, you know, he shouldn't feel any anger about this or any guilt. There was a certain, you know, do what thou wilt philosophy which he was adhering to, but it obviously troubled him that his best friend at the time, L. Ron Hubbard, had kind of, you know, moved in with his girlfriend, and he couldn't quite control his own rage. And he had, you know, he had recently done a magical working with L. Ron Hubbard to kind of create a new girlfriend, his elemental, as he called it, an elemental working, which Crowley was furious about. He said, they're trying to create a moon child. You know, we don't, you know, what are they thinking of? But Parsons was very keen on creating this, you know, a new woman in his life, somebody who could be linked kind of magically to him, yet also personally and sexually to him. And that was Marjorie Cameron. Marjorie Cameron came into his life. Parsons declared her his elemental, and together they worked on this, you know, it's magical working called the Babylon working. Now, you know, the Babylon he was talking about, as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, is the kind of the biblical Babylon, or at least the one which kind of Crowley co-opted as the scarlet woman who rides on the back of the beast. And I think Parsons saw his Babylon working, which he intended as being the creation of a goddess who would be born on Earth. He saw this as being kind of supplementary to the beast, literally his Babylon would ride on the back of Crowley's beasts, and kind of become a kind of extra book to Crowley's teachings. And it's interesting because a lot of the language that we get in Parsons' Babylon working, we know he worked for about 2 months on it, kind of daily magical rituals with Hubbard, using, Enochian magic, lots of kind of self-created magic too. You know, there was a lot of, sex magic, masturbatory magic, the fertilizing of scrolls with one's own semen, that kind of idea of trying to force something into life. And this went on for kind of 2 months. And it's interesting that a lot of the language involved is of flame and is of destruction and is of Babylon coming, sweeping in like this kind of fiery demoness almost into the world. And I mean, I wonder whether this was, as somebody who's not a magician themselves, who isn't, a believer in this, I can't help but throw on a kind of psychological kind of background to this. And a will of Parsons to change his life, in this incredible way by creating a goddess. I mean, there's the Freudian idea of, the Madonna whore complex, and the idea that, men can't desire women they can respect, and they can't respect women they desire. And Parsons is at this kind of stage whereby he's creating, the whore Babylon, a goddess who is a whore. And he's trying to kind of create this kind of new kind of way of living, this kind of way that you could satisfy desire and kind of respect. He was trying to create a new way of going about that. He went on to write further about an all-female religion, the witchcraft, which we'll probably talk about in a bit. But I think he was really trying to just create a new way. He didn't find that Thelema had worked for him. He couldn't control his anger at the loss of his loves or, his friendship being betrayed. And so he was trying to find something else, a new way through his magic. That's how I see the Babylon working. And I'm sure it'll infuriate lots of people. But it's how I'm seeing it at the moment.
Okay. So what was the all-female sort of witchcraft that he was writing about?
Well, this was something he wrote actually towards the end of his life, and this is kind of quite a lot further. He thought the Babylon working had succeeded, and that somewhere in the world Babylon warped and was about to usher in this new age. And the new age, he went on to kind of supplement it with the witchcraft, which I haven't read the witchcraft for a while, but it was very much a kind of an all-female religion, or at least a religion in which women, are in charge to a certain respect. And it's all focused on womanhood. I mean, in many ways, it's a kind of pagan religion. It's rather like Wicca, a kind of precursor to that. And it's not very well, it's not really written in exactly what it is. It's rather abstruse. But it just seems to be this yearning for a female religion in which man is in some way subsumed to women, or is in some way kind of helped along by them, by the natural magical forces that women hold themselves.
Why do you think that connection for Parsons to a woman was so important?
I mean, there are psychological reasons, there are kind of literary reasons. I mean, interestingly, a guiding text for Parsons is a science fiction book called Darker Than You Think. And I don't think we should see it as ridiculous that a science fiction book could cause somebody to want to kind of create a magical world around it. When you look at Scientology itself. But Darker Than You Think is all about a man who stumbles upon a conspiracy, a world conspiracy. And it's a world conspiracy that the world is run by witches. That there are witches, throughout society, at all levels of society, that it's a classic conspiracy theory that are covering up the fact that witches are everywhere. And this man kind of tries to undercover it until he starts realizing that maybe he is a witch himself. And it has, this incredible image, which is similar to Crowley's images of Babylon, is of, the main character in the book, transforming into a kind of giant beast upon whom the witches ride. And you know, it's incredible how that book, along with Crowley's writings, kind of meshed together and created this idea of a kind of coven, of a coven life, of a new world in which, you know, the strength of women should be paramount. And I mean, it's quite radical for a guy in, you know, the 40s to be thinking this. I mean, I guess The White Goddess was written around the same time. But yeah, I'm not quite sure why Parsons felt it, but could it be that he was raised by his mother? Could it be that, you know, he had all these very strong women in his life, like Marjorie Cameron? I'm not entirely sure. But he was definitely set, you know, on a kind of feminine route into magical life.
Okay, I mean the mother angle seems like the most practical one there. So I mean, I guess this is a sort of a not a controversial question, but a question which comes up for even those who might have just had a tertiary glance at Parsons' biography, which is, you know, his death, right? So it's strange. So there's sort of conspiracies relating to it, because he's in his garage. He's known to not really handle his explosives all that well, and he blows himself up. He's taken to hospital and dies at hospital. But there's some conspiracies, you know, around this. I mean, what was your take on these?
Well, I mean, they're all persuasive. You know, at the time, he was, you know, this is late in his life. He had just been, you know, he'd been blacklisted from the scientific community, not actually for his magic, but for his links to communists. He had been, you know, he had lost his job. He was working, making special effects for Hollywood movies. You know, the guy who helped create the rocketry field in America was kind of making squibs, you know, for movies. And, you know, some people think, you know, it just all gone too far. It was suicide. You know, he couldn't go any further. I mean, other people think he was actually, as I said, he was always looking for phenomena in his magical works. And this was just, you know, a magical working that had gone wrong. And it's true. He was always pushing his magical work through, you know, not only through rituals, but through the use of drugs, through everything, through every angle he could possibly, you know, he could get some grip on. And so, you know, some people thought it was a magical ritual gone horribly wrong. You know, other factors that, you know, when he had been young, he had, you know, been an expert in a court case, in a court trial against an LA cop who had car bombed people. They're not entirely ridiculous. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, you weigh them up and you see them all and you try and look at Parsons as the person he was at the time. And you see he was actually reconciled with Marjorie Cameron, his wife, with Cameron. And he was about to head off to Mexico to start a whole new life, it seemed. And, you know, Occam's razor suggests that the simplest idea is probably the most right one. And as you say, he was renowned for not mixing his chemicals carefully. He was known to sweat, and he was known to be on amphetamines quite a lot at the time. And it just seems like it was a horrible accident that he was mixing these explosives for the movies, and something dropped, and because nothing was stored correctly, because he was, you know, just so, you know, cavalier, because he knew how chemicals worked. He slept with them. He slept on cases of dynamite. You know, he was fine with it because he was so casual. He just, this one tragic moment before he set off on his new life, you know, just killed him. That's, I'm not 100% happy with it. But that's, if I had to, you know, bet on it, if you can bet on a man's life, that's what I would bet on.
Okay. And how long does it take for his sort of infamy? Because after his death, his you know, knowledge of him and his work and his place in Thelema sort of dies down. But then it suddenly, you know, has a sort of revitalization a little bit later. I mean, how long does this take to sort of come back to, you know, back to life?
Oh, it takes quite a while. I mean, it's partly helped by the kind of resurgence of Crowley in the 60s. You know, you have him kind of slowly becoming more and more influential. But for Parsons himself, it's not really until, I would say, the 80s, perhaps, late 70s, when, and it's purely down to the OTO. The OTO just managed to survive despite Parsons' death and despite Crowley's death and despite shrinking to a very small group. they just manage to survive long enough that Parsons slowly, you know, gets kind of revived, or his writings do. Hymenas Beta, who is the head of the OTA at the moment, you know, published a small, slender book of Parsons' writing back in maybe the early 80s, almost like a zine, you know. And then, you know, slowly word gets around, and the OTO eventually publish a collection of his writings called Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword, which are some of his writings from later in his life, which are kind of very libertarian. They have this kind of mixture of magical and libertarian writings. And I think that's probably in the 90s or the late 80s. But, you know, really, I think Parsons really becomes known until really the late 90s. And, I mean, I don't want to kind of give myself any credits, but I think my book helps a bit in getting it out there. You know, at least after my book, there was a Wikipedia page came up, you know, which there wasn't before, which I think, you know, is a sign that at least you're recognized somewhat. But he was really forgotten about. And for some reason, he's just caught people's attention. I think perhaps because he wasn't, he wasn't a devout Crowleyite, because he kind of trod his own way, you know, touching on all these other worlds. People, there's a certain kind of individuality to it, which means to kind of be interested in Parsons doesn't mean you have to commit to the OTO or to the Golden Dawn or to any particular kind of type of magic, even, you know, or any particular type of science, really, for that. You know, it's more a kind of mindset, I think, that people have bought into, the Parsons idea that, you know, anything is possible.
Okay. You mentioned the writing. I mean, what was where did you find the majority of the research for this? Was a lot in one place, like with the OTO, or was this
the OTO? You know, the OTO did actually have a lot of his writings, and they were a huge help. And it was split between the OTO and the Warburg Institute in London, which holds Gerald York's papers, which has, you know, also a collection of a lot of Parsons' work. You know, unfortunately, Cameron had burnt a lot of Parsons' writings shortly after Parsons died. So there was a huge swathe which has been lost to us. But as I kind of went around, I picked up pieces here and there. The Cameron Parsons Foundation, which has only recently been set up but has been collected for almost 20, 30 years, you know, has been an organization which tries to collect the writings of both of them, both Cameron and Parsons. And they were a great help too. But a lot of it, you know, a lot of his scientific stuff, that was just digging through archives at Caltech, which was the university that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory was based at. And, you know, there was one guy there, a professor called, or rather a librarian called John Bluth, Dr. John Bluth, who, when he first arrived there, found Parsons' writings just filling up cracks in the walls. You know, they were just being there used to block drafts. And he, thankfully, he like collected all these writings and put them together. And he, as well as the OTO pushing Parsons, there was also this very light push from this one guy, John Bluth, who was desperately trying to get Parsons' name out there to anybody who was interested. And, you know, he did a lot to kind of, you know, to keep Parsons' writings together and to try and spread the word out. And he was a great help too.
Yeah, I guess that's a more contentious question is, you know, is there any, you know, is his influence, you say that they sort of wanted nothing to do when you offered an interview, but has there recently been any sort of acknowledgement of, okay, here's a complete pioneer of rocketry, or are they still sort of keeping him at arm's length?
They haven't gone that far. You know, up until a few years ago, they didn't even mention him on their website. Which is kind of ridiculous because he was one of their founders. But, you know, then again, they don't mention a lot of their founders, because their founders, a lot of them were caught up in the, you know, communist witch hunts after the war. You know, and when you add kind of a magician to the communists, you know, it becomes a very difficult path to kind of, you know, to kind of pass. They've been a little more, they do now have him on the website. I think, you know, a lot of people do, there, you know, there was a little plaque put up to him. I mean, this is decades ago now, a little plaque put up to him and the other members of his group of rocketeers on the site where they held their first test. It's slowly coming about. I think it's more coming about just through the scientists who are working there now rather than from up top. It's kind of growing from a ground level. I think a lot of the scientists are interested in it, even if the, you know, the main scientific body isn't.
Okay. Is there anyone specifically writing who, like, either in magic or, I guess, less so in rocketry, who sort of specifically, you know, not just Thelema, but says, you know, almost they might recognize themselves as a, I guess you'd call them a Parsonian?
Ah, gosh, I don't know. I mean, Parsons was such a unique figure. I don't want to keep beating that, but it's hard to kind of match oneself against Parsons, just because he was in so many different worlds. He was in the science fiction world. He was in the science world. He was in the occult world. He was. I don't think anybody has that breadth. Weirdly, I mean, in many ways, you know, Parsons. I think some people call Newton the last of the alchemists, but in some ways Parsons was, you know, because he was really the last person who could keep in their mind the ideas that magic and science can coexist. And maybe it's just gone away for a little bit and it's going to resurge, you know, later on. Certainly, you know, the recent studies of the history of magic, you know, now don't see magic as being like a precursor to religion and science, but more as a part of a kind of triple helix with religion and science. And I think that's a great step forward for magic. But I think Parsons himself, I can't really call to mind anybody who's, you know, who's anywhere as weird as Parsons in their interests and accomplishments.
Okay, I think, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think that would probably be quite difficult to find anyway.
I mean, some people say Musk, Elon Musk, you know, is he the equivalent? But, you know, maybe in his technology and his love of kind of, you know, kind of pop culture too. But I just don't see there being a depth to him, which, you know, a magical depth to him, a philosophical depth to him, which kind of Parsons had. So, you know, that's the closest, you know, some people have said.
Is there anything you'd like to add about the book that you feel we've, well, obviously there's a lot more going on, so I guess one thing that we sort of missed, but I don't think there's too much of, like, depth there, is that Parsons is in contact and meets up with Robert Heinlein quite a few times, but I don't think much comes of that. I mean, you know, you said earlier of the libertarian writings, and I guess he's probably influenced by Heinlein a bit there.
Yes, definitely, very much so. I mean, you know, Parsons and science fiction's link is fascinating because Parsons got so much from science fiction, from Heinlein's writings, just in because a lot of early science fiction was very technical. You know, there was a lot of, actually, let's make a booster by putting these rockets together like this and this. You know, Parsons saw those pretty much as technical writings for his rocketry. You know, he would try what one of these writers suggested, and if it didn't work, well, so be it. But I mean, yeah, there was definitely a libertarian strain from Heinlein. The writers themselves from Parsons, they took a little from him. You know, you see Parsons pop up in a few stories from the time, you know, that they wrote. There's a couple of stories in which, you know, one called Rocket to the Morgue, which, you know, one of the great pop writers kind of wrote, which features, you know, a dead ringer for Parsons. You know, and some people have suggested that he pops up in Heinlein's writings, or at least parts of his character do. But more of a relationship, it's hard to know. I actually, funnily enough, I recently uncovered a new letter from Heinlein to Parsons, which, you know, just in the last year, which is asking about him and L. Ron, and they were obviously close. And I think Heinlein, you know, really enjoyed the fact that he had on his doorstep pretty much a practicing magician and rocket scientist, because that was the kind of guy I'd been writing about for the last 20 years. You know, it's like, it was as if somebody had actually burst into reality from his pages.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's more unlikely to say that, you know, Parsons would have influenced Heinlein. He was a Heinleinian figure, if there ever was one.
I think so. And there's something about, you know, the scientist spaceman kind of hero of the early stories, which isn't too dissimilar from kind of the magician hero, you know, that this guy going forward into the future bravely using things that nobody else understands. You know, and I think Parsons acted as that for a lot of the science fiction community. He acted as this you know, poll that maybe, just maybe, their stories could kind of, you know, in a Borgesian way, kind of, you know, make their way into real life.
So, yeah, is there anything you'd like to add about the book that you feel is key that we've missed?
Well, not really. I mean, what I've always wanted for the book is that, you know, Parson's story just gets out there and people do with it what they will. Because I just think he was forgotten about both accidentally and intentionally for so long that, you know, really writing the book was just about getting the story out there and then seeing how people run with it. And it's been interesting to see how his popularity has grown since the book has come out and just how many people see him as a guiding figure, or at least as an inspirational figure. And I think he would have loved that.
Are you working on anything at the moment? Anything big, or is it just articles?
I'm just working on small kind of articles at the moment. I'm waiting to kind of find the next big story. The problem with a story like Parsons is once you've done it, it's hard to find anything, you know, that kind of matches it in terms of strangeness and depth and just pure kind of sheer weirdness. So I'm kind of constantly hunting for the next story, but it'll be hard to cap Parsons.
Okay. Is there anywhere we can find your work? Or
you can find me online. I'm on, you know, George Pendlet Twitter, which has a link to lots of my articles there. And you know, I'm always writing for various publications. I have an authory page, if people are familiar with that. But mainly through Twitter, I post all my stuff up there.
Okay, I think that's a good place to finish up. George Pendle, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.